You're listening or watching Real Conversations with Jacob Young. Real Conversations is sponsored by Boys Town. Boys Town has been saving children, healing families for over 100 years. Please go to boystown.org to see how you can help the girls and boys of Boys Town. And while you're there, be sure to check out all their free parenting tips that they offer. Now, my guest this week is a best-selling author and a motivational speaker who has inspired and coached individuals around the world to be more. In fact, one of his best-selling books is called Be More: How Wanting to Die Inspired Me to Live. From a working-class family in Northern England, he became the youngest partner in a top law firm within 10 years of graduating college. He's an incredibly successful businessman who seemed to have everything but inner peace and happiness. The day he almost ended his life, he finally began to live. With what he's learned along the way, he now coaches clients that include Fortune 500 members, global brands, government agencies, and tech startup companies. He's the author of the number one Amazon bestseller, Unlocking a More Productive You. Joining me from England today is my guest, Charlie Hugh Jones. You know what time it is. It's time to keep it real with Real Conversations with Jacob Young. Charlie.
Hi, Jacob. Great to be on the show. Thank you. Appreciate that. What an introduction. It's always weird when you hear someone telling some part of your story in a way. It's like, oh my goodness, how am I going to live up to that? To the people that, we go through and learn. I'm loving the beard, by the way, man. That's quite some weight there.
Well, thank you. You as well, man. It's just sometimes in the winter, I guess. I always call it my winter beard. I'm jumping in and I always tend to grow it out a little bit more if I have the time to do it, of course, and also depending on the film projects that I'm working
Absolutely.
Well, I thank you for joining me all the way from England. I've been looking forward to having a conversation with you because you've been on a journey that has really made you wise for your years.
Oh, yikes. I don't know about wise, but certainly there's a wisdom that we may come across. And if we have the presence to be able to connect with it, then maybe we even get the opportunity to share it with other people, and it can be for them as well. Someone once said to me, what have you got in your store cupboard? Because what you've got in your store cupboard is what you can share with somebody else when they come around. And that's how wisdom isn't about making me wise. It's about what capacity do I have to be, for other people. So.
Well, thank you. In the business world, you were really killing it. How did you get to the day that when you literally wanted to kill yourself?
I think one of the things about killing it in the business world is how much of a knife edge that can be for some people sometimes. The thing is, for me, killing it was, what bigger risk can I take to get a bigger reward? And that sounds fairly healthy. It sounds fairly like, yeah, this is the go-getter attitude. This is what you do. And for me, I had gone from being an attorney, a partner in a law firm, to being a strategist, to working with private equity on the west coast of the States in San Francisco. And I had constructed this world in my head of how successful I was as a strategist for other people, playing three-dimensional chess with the future, figuring out how things are going to work and how do you put things together so that people can get the outcomes they want. But my own life was a mess. The point that you said in the intro about, I looked like I had absolutely everything apart from inner peace. That's so, so right. How did I get there? Well, what it took was me finally having a reckoning with some of the messes that I'd made while appearing successful. And when I say appearing successful, I mean getting money, getting a house, getting the car, being married to a beautiful woman, all those things sound really great. Okay. Until you find out that, the house is mortgaged, the beautiful woman you haven't built a deep, intimate relationship with, and all the other things are not as firm foundations as you think they are. And part of the lesson for me was around, okay, what's real and what's not. So making lots of money can be one thing. And having amazing opportunities and seeing avenues to pursue and then bringing people into it. So that can create success, doing good things for the people. But if fundamentally you are struggling inside, you don't have any kind of peace, then, you know, what I was refusing to acknowledge was how more and more depressed I was becoming in the midst of that.
Yeah.
And I was getting more and more depressed. And so what it took were a critical thing outside of my control. A particular deal didn't go the way I wanted to, and I was over-relying on the income from that coming in, which we all do to one degree or another.
Sure.
You know, mortgaging our future is something that we're in a habit of doing as human beings. We do it all the time. Yeah. But I was like so invested in this project having to come through, and it collapsed overnight. There was no way it should have done. It was amazing. And I was like, I have no income. I got no revenue. I got nothing coming into the house. And I had loads and loads of overheads, loads of stuff that I've already committed to paying for. And that was like, oh, you know, I didn't know how to deal with the internal feelings of that. The shame, the failure. Everyone sees you as a success. And by rights, you look like a success. You've got it, you know. But I didn't know what to do. Where was my way out? I had no way out. And the crushing depression that had been creeping on for so long that I wasn't acknowledging just got to breaking point. And I was like, okay. And sometimes this gets hard to talk about and sometimes it's not. It depends who I'm talking with. Mm. But I got to the point where the only way my crazy, twisted, distorted logic as a strategist could figure out of the financial situation was a life insurance claim by my former wife to pay for everything and sort everything out, because that will sort it out. That will take the pressure off. If I end it, that, you know. And these thoughts are really common. When you begin to have conversations with people, it's not just people that, you know, there are so many people I've spoken to in the last sort of, you know, X number of years since that happened, that those thoughts are fairly common. Oh, the only way out of this hopeless situation is X.
Yeah.
And X means the end of me. So I came to that, what I thought was rational conclusion, but it's distorted logic. It's never the answer. It's just where you get to. And I had a plan, because I'm always a guy with a plan, or I always had been. The strategist has a plan and you execute on the plan. So it was, that's where I'm going to get to. And then something else crashed into my world, which blew up the plan, made it far more acute, you know. However, logically, I'd come to the conclusion that ending my life was appropriate. You know, the intense pain of another particular incident, which I tell in the book about being in a marriage counseling session with, you know, my former wife, where she discloses that she's in love with somebody else and doesn't want to be in our marriage anymore. That, on top of me being a failure financially in my own world, is just catastrophic. And it's very hard to find words. We rely on words so much. Very hard to find words to try and capture and then convey the level of despair and tortured soul and agony of life that psychic pain can be for some people. And in that moment, I experienced it, you know, and that was, there were no words. It's like, there's this amazing painter, you know, very dark painter based in Manchester years and years ago, who did this amazing painter called The Scream. And you see this picture of this, a lot of people recognize that.
I know the piece.
Like, it resonates for a lot of people, because it's like there's an energy to it and an endless, hopeless darkness to it that has pain and physical pain and mental pain, and it blocks everything else out. And it was like, my plan went to bits then. And in that moment, it was just, this has to end. The only way of ending this is now. And everything in me is screaming, that's the end. And I'm in my car and I'm trying to figure out how I can press, you know, the gas to go as fast as I can in this really nice sports car, which would have to be an awful lot of speed in order to hurt me. And my body won't let me. So that's where I got to.
Yeah.
3 months earlier, and no one would have known, because I was hiding the depression, first off. And that's the biggest thing, hiding the fact that I was depressed.
I definitely want to, you know, acknowledge the fact that you have opened up about this, how important it is, where so many, I mean, it's a difficult situation, whether you're a man or a woman, but I see time and time again, I read article time and time again about men who have been in similar situations, financial strain. There was just a guy last week in New York that ended his life. And he was an investment banker, or he had some investment company, and they found out that he was in debt and his wife, they were not getting along, and he did that. But, you know, I guess what I wanted to say is, you know, what, you, I mean, your body didn't let you, but once that happened and you realized like how close that could have been, how did you begin to that, get to that path of healing?
Yeah. I think that's the, that's one of the things that, that becomes very personal for everybody. There's no prescription. For me, you know, where I got to when I'm trying to drive my car into this bridge pylon on this highway near us, you know, somehow I ended up in a physician's office who I'd spoken to on the phone, but I had never actually visited, never seen face to face. And apparently I staggered in there. I abandoned my car. It looked completely just, you know, halfway on a road, halfway off a road outside. And I'd, you know, staggered into this office and I was just catatonic for a couple of hours. Fast forward, you know, I didn't know exactly what was going on then, but afterwards the recollection was something had happened, some kind of psychotic break, some kind of how I thought about me and what was really going on in the world got disconnected. And that gave me space for the first time in my world ever. Might only have been momentary, but I felt peace like I'd never felt before in that moment. I felt connected to everything. I felt everything was going to be okay. And the journey to healing was, okay, I got that pause. Some people don't. Many, many people don't, especially those who are actually successful in taking their lives. I got that pause. And it was beginning to appreciate that I now have an opportunity to perhaps consider and reflect upon what had got me to that point and then what I was going to do differently, you know, and that's a choice that isn't the same for everybody. You know, I then did some therapy and, you know, for a couple of weeks, and that was just about, okay, how do you become slightly more active in the reflection and then what you're going to do differently? So it was a very practical therapy. It wasn't until I got introduced to, you know, more practices around mindfulness or other things that I had put in a box somewhere that were not for me, that actually gave me an opportunity to begin to explore things that I didn't necessarily understand, but could help me become more centered, help me become more present, help me become more grateful, help me become more aware of things way bigger than me. I think one of the things that, depression and despair does, it makes you so self-centered. You become so captivated by your own story, usually negative, your own pain. You isolate yourself from everybody. So part of the healing journey was, how do you open up again? How do you see a world that's bigger than the world you created for yourself in your head? How do you begin to appreciate the little things that you took for granted? How do you practice things that expand that? And so my journey over the few years that followed was basically relearning how to be a human being, you know? Yeah, I thought I got it nailed. I thought I knew exactly how to be successful, how to be a strategist so you can outthink people, how to be super competitive, how to make loads of money, how to, you know, and I didn't know how to be a good human being.
It's so enlightening because right now I'm as somebody who has struggled with mental health issues my entire life, depression, social anxieties, not a great, you know, role for me to be in as far as an actor in television and having social anxiety. So it was always like this little secret that I was keeping, and I was numbing it with, you know, drug use and all sorts of things just so I could feel normal. Yeah. You've said, you know, you've talked about, we all can get into trouble by believing the stories that we make up about ourselves. What exactly does that mean? And how does one fix that?
Fix is not a word I'm going to use.
Okay.
There's a journey through, but that's interesting. But what I mean by that, it was my mind, powerful, you know, good thing. It's a great tool, your mind, but it is a very bad master, you know, to use that word. Or, you know, it's great if you know how to use it, but if it's controlling you, oh. What I mean is our minds are story-making machines. That's how we make sense of the world. You know, stories are how we experience the world. All these sensations, all this wonderful stuff. If you get into the neurophysiology, we are incredibly wonderful, you know, experiences of reality. But our mind interprets it and tells a story about it. Mm. Now, my mind told me a story about how successful I was, and then it told me a story about how unsuccessful I was, how shameful, how what have you. The story that I was battling with for years, and you talked about numbing social anxiety with alcohol or drugs or what have you, I numbed my anxiety, and I numbed the story that my, so the anxiety that my story was creating by being busy, by doing more. And that's one of the reasons I was compelled to write the book. Because my mind was telling me, you'll never be enough. You can never do enough. And part of me that was kind of like the rebel was like, no, I'll prove to you I can do this. I'm going to do so much. I'm just going to prove I can do so much. Look how much I can do. Look how many people I can help. And that became the next narrative. But it was fundamentally more. You're not enough. Do more. And we feel like that. And that comes from a fear of rejection. That comes from a fear of not experiencing love. There's all kinds of reasons that are very, very common in the human condition that create a story. The difficulty that I had was separating what was really going on in the world in whatever moment I was in with the story. It's about, you know, our stories, we look at the past and we go, oh, that hurt, or that didn't work, or that did work, I'll repeat it. And then we look in the future and we go, hey, if we do more of that, we'll either get hurt more. So that's how we end up ruining loads of relationships, because you bring the last relationship into the next relationship. And that's everything from parenting, like your parents parented you, to relationships, to sex, to all kinds of stuff, to business, to the boardroom, to investors. You treat them as you see them, as you interpret them, rather than what's actually going on. So coming back to that point, you know, we believe the stories are just one interpretation. Part of the practice for me, and I talk about it being a practice, it's not a fix, is how do I step back from the story? Is there any space I can create to actually discern what's really going on? I don't mean what's the story, because I can observe the story in my mind. It's like a one Michael Singer talks about it being like the movie that's going on in your head. So there's actually what's going on out there, and then there's the movie you're projecting about what's going on out there in your head. And the moment you begin to realize that you're watching the movie, you are not the movie, that's when a distinction takes place. And it's like, oh, I can suddenly see I'm the one who's watching the movie. So that movie is about me, but it's not actually me. What's actually going on for me here? And sometimes that moment, that pause, which can be a split second, is sufficient for us to gain perspective and to find the space to shift the energy that's causing all the other stuff. Because anxiety is a physiological manifestation. You know, we can talk about anxiety, we can talk about stress, we can talk about the HPA axis, we can look at all the factors that contribute to it, and whether it starts with a story in the mind or whether it starts with a physical sensation. And these two things go round and round. And our thinking, if we believe our thoughts, and this isn't about saying your thoughts are betraying you, it's just like, remember, it's a story-making machine. It's designed to help interpret. It's not designed to observe. So for me, the journey has been learning how to observe without telling the story.
Yeah.
That takes, for me, there's lots of different ways I have to practice that to get back to that place. And for other people, they use different things. For some people, it's faith and religion. For others, it's meditation. For some people, it's adventure sports. For other people, it's walk in the park. For some people, it's journaling. For other people, you know, there are lots of ways to it. But what is it that can help you, just small steps on a daily basis, create a little bit of space between the story your mind's telling and what you're actually experiencing. It's very rare that we are truly in danger. And I'm not talking about people who suffer abuse and people in war zones or what have you, but us in the Western world, it's very rare we're often in danger. And yet our nervous system reacts to our thoughts as if we're in danger.
Sure.
Creates the anxiety reflex, which is exactly what it is, reflex. And then the reflex gives us loads of signals that are familiar from when we were in danger at some point in the past, pings the story back up and goes, there you go. You're in danger. When you weren't, you could have just had a spider crawl across your leg while you were watching TV on the sofa and what have you. And that's all it was, nothing. But you're like, whoa. And then next someone says something in the room and you react out of anger because anger is a manifestation of fear. And so it's about creating space. And for me, one of the things I had to do was to slow down.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that. Slowing down, you've written also that slowing down. Well, first of all, we go to that. I just want to say one thing that stood out, what you were telling me with your own, you know, the way you were dealing with it by saying that I had to stay busy. To me, that's really scary because that's when you go, well, they seemed like they had it all together. They were, you know, they were very productive. They were always going over the top. They were always making sure that everything was okay. And, you know, and I don't know, that just, that hasn't been my experience. Unfortunately, I wear all my emotions on my sleeve and people go, hey, what's going on? But then I lie. You know, I don't tell them the truth. And that took me years and years to figure out, like, it's okay to open up to somebody if they're asking. But you had written, moving back forward, that slowing down helps us go faster. How does that apply?
Yeah. Well, for me, I think often, if you're running really, really fast and your laces come undone, you might not have that with a pair of Yeezys or whatever, but, you know, or whatever this, but if your laces come undone, you're likely to trip up and fall over, right? So it's like, whoa, if you can stop long enough to tie the laces and just check the laces are okay, you know, these are solidly tied, well done, good, then you can run, you know, and rather than trip in the middle of the run, you're going to get all the way there. Now, your laces might not come undone, but for those of us who they did come undone, I wasn't paying attention to my laces. That's one analogy. Slowing down to go faster. I have regularly found that if I go into a meeting and I think I know what's going to happen and how this meeting is going to go, and I've got the next meeting on my mind because I've got to get to that one. So this, I've just got to hit these 3 points and then you've got to move on. And by the end of the day, I've got that one over there. You can miss the one moment in that meeting where somebody else perhaps had this incredibly creative idea and you didn't create the space to entertain it and explore it because you knew how the meeting was going to go because you were thinking about the next meeting, the meeting after that. And you're so good at managing the world and everything that you can just align everything. And you can convince yourself that forward motion and speed is progress. But you might miss that moment that actually opened up a completely different avenue to explore or opportunity. And that happens in relationships as much as it helps in business. You know, you're sitting there talking to someone who you're in relationship with, but actually your mind's thinking about how they're going to respond to the way you say something and somebody else says that. You're not present for them to actually be who they are. You've already interpreted them. You've already decided how, because you've had 4 conversations with them before, so you think you know them. And if you think you're very good at reading people, you're wrong. You've just been good at reading people in the past. You're not actually reading the person in front of you. So slowing down for me to go faster is about, oh, what is really going on here? Can I be humble enough? This is me, you know, because this is the lesson I had to regularly. Can I be humble enough to go, I don't know what's going on here? Anything my mind tells me thinks is going on, that's okay. That's one version of it. But there might be others. Can I create the space for others to show up? And I was never any good at that because I knew what was going on. I knew how people work. I knew how to press the buttons. I knew to get deals done until I stopped. And slowing down means sometimes just like going, you walk into a meeting or you walk into and you stop. Check in with yourself. What's going on emotionally? What's going on energetically? How fast is my breathing? I'm just going to focus on the reality of me being a physical being in the space before I enter that meeting.
Yeah.
And that could take 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So slowing down as you walk through the door to go, I'm just taking a moment to be, so that I can be present for the people in the room rather than be in the next bit of the meeting because I've got my to-do list and I've got this and I know what I'm managing. And, you know, and for you, maybe I'm doing this audition, but actually the part I really want is the next audition, you know, which is a couple of hours away. So I'm thinking about that and I don't want to give this my everything because actually if I get this part, I might not get that. Whatever.
There's ways you exactly. Could.
But it's about being present. And I often talk about how much of you can you bring to the present moment. And what I mean by it is your attention, your awareness. This phenomenal mind that we have that we can make stories is also an incredible, incredible observation machine. The ability for us to take in stimuli from taste to touch to sight. I mean, what we can interpret as this sight is amazing. You know, if we can turn that on rather than just the story-making part, we become so much more alive to what is going on, not what we think is going on. And then when we do that, we've slowed down, but you can often accomplish far more. Some of the best ideas, some of the relationship breakthroughs, some of the moments of appreciation and love that kind of spin into moments of awe have all come from slowing down.
Yeah.
For me, anyway.
And yeah, no, I think it relates to most of our lives because we're so caught up with our own lives, our own moment to moment, what's happening. I recently, you know, I had to check myself with that too. I've got three kids. My son's 14, and I don't feel like I've checked in with him enough early on in his life. And I've realized I've made that adjustment now with my daughters who are younger. And now I'm trying to make that adjustment with him. But I was, you know, thinking I had to try to figure it. I was figuring it all out, or I was putting a cap on everything and not telling the whole truth. And I feel like if we all could kind of take that, the expression, you know, stop and smell the roses kind of comes to mind when you're saying that. And those little things that happen day to day that I would just rush past now means more to me than anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And so for me, I immediately think about, oh, your son, and you think, oh, I didn't do that when he was younger. Well, what have you got, Jacob, right now? What have you got? You have this moment with him. You have the next moment he walks in the middle of the podcast, if he knocks on the door, and you're like, oh, no, I'm doing a podcast. I say, no, come on in. Whatever, I'm joking.
Yeah.
But you have that. You cannot change the past, nor can you change his experience of his past interaction with you. What you have total control over is what you bring to the next moment with him.
Right.
You are all powerful in that moment of who you bring. If you choose to bring the lack and the grief over what I didn't do in the past to that moment, it becomes earnest and you try and make the moment so big. Or you can go, that was then, this is now. He's getting a bowl of Cheerios right now in the fridge and I'm leaning on the kitchen island. It's like, hey, how you doing? And then you're silent. You don't need to fill that space with a 14-year-old. And they don't either. It could just be, Marie.
Yeah.
But as long as you're present, they recognize it and they know.
Right.
So you can give that gift to your kids, the gift of presence, the gift of that moment. And then, you know, parenting is always about stringing consistent moments together at some point, you know, so you can do it again and you can do it again. The past is the past. You cannot change that, whatever that is. And I've had to grapple with that. And for me, you know, I realize that I thought I was a good dad. So there you go. There's another story. I thought I was a good dad because physically I was present and I did lots of things with my kids. Where was my attention? On work, on solving the next problem, on something else. So I might have looked like I was there for some period, but emotionally I wasn't available for them. Mm-hmm. And I realized, like, it's okay when I'm reading a story, you know, I've got the book out and it's bedtime and I'm doing that, like, yeah, I could do bedtime and bath time, but I'm still like, yeah, this is what you do. And I'll read it really with great intonation and they'll have a great experience, but I'm not actually listening to them. I'm not there. And that's been a lot of the process for me, is being present, being there. And that's where the book was, you know, for me, the fundamental message of be more was not everyone becomes Zen, go up a mountain, sit cross-legged and just until, you know, something changes in the world. It is practical. It was like, how can I be more present so that I can balance out the doing? Because we still got to do stuff. You've got to, you know, change the bed sheets and do the washing. You've got to, you know, make the investment and take decisions. You know, you've got to do stuff. You can't just become this, you know, being in the world. But you can do it more presently. Yeah. You can bring more of you to each of those encounters and go, there you go. That's what I'm giving my son. He might not reciprocate. He might be a teenager. He might be on his phone. That's fine. But you brought you.
Right.
See what happens.
Yeah, such great advice. I've struggled with that. I think a lot of people do. But to remind ourselves to be present and not live in the past and carry the grief. I can't tell you, like, there's random thoughts that pop in my head and be like, remember that time I was supposed to give that speech and I messed up, or, and mm-hmm. I feel like I made a complete embarrassment of myself or whatever that was, or was my kids or, and, yeah. And even though I've moved past that, I really haven't, because that thought keeps kind of coming up. Right. Or I'm not allowing myself to forgive myself and be in the present.
Yeah. That's a really powerful point you just made. I'm not allowing myself to forgive myself and be in the present. You know, sometimes we think forgiveness is excusing stuff. It's not. Forgiveness is choosing to fully acknowledge what was wrong and go, yeah, but here's an opportunity to do it differently. Okay. That's forgiveness. So forgiveness can be, you know, it took me ages to really process and then accept I couldn't have done it differently, because, you know, the wonderful world of, oh, if only I could go back, I would do it differently. Actually, I couldn't do it differently. The level of consciousness that I had, the way I was. So there is zero energy that can be created from trying to spend my mind's time figuring out what to do differently in the past. If I choose to do something different in this moment now, that matters. That's energy. That will create a new relationship, new connection, what have you. The past, no. Mm. But the mind likes to run through the story because it thinks in linear time.
Yeah.
So it goes, what happened in the past? Oh, we're now skip over right now and we'll project that onto the future, because that's where our problems lie. And if we can learn from what we did wrong in the past, we'll avoid those in the future. But, you know, I had a wonderful lesson driving a racing car a couple of years back, where the guy noticed I kept looking at the ditch on the inside of the road, and I kept going into the ditch. And he said, every time you look at the thing you don't want to happen, you're more likely to go there.
Yeah.
And I was like, huh, every time you look at the thing that you don't want to happen, you're more likely to go there. And it's like, when we project what didn't go right in the past onto the future, we are more likely to repeat it.
Right.
So how do you go, yes, that did happen in the past, but I have an opportunity right now. I have the space, perhaps, to do something different. Am I going to take that choice? Okay. And then it's a question of resourcing oneself up to be able to make a different choice. Because there's a whole load of practical stuff that I had to get into. So it's all right having these thoughts and reflecting, do that. I had to practically then turn it into something that would support a different choice in parenting, in the way I do deals, in the way I take care of my body. You know, I look 10 years younger now than I looked 10 years ago. You know, I had messed up my immune system, my body, my everything. I had, yeah, didn't know how to take care of myself, and I thought I did. But I had to make practical changes to the way I do life and my lifestyle in order to have this experience of being well.
Yeah.
So not only do I need to have the thought, reflect, and do the acceptance piece, I actually do need to do something different. So being and doing are like an infinity sign. they are linked. You know, you can't have one without the other. So I did loads of doing over this end, and this bit was all falling apart. If you go over this end and go up a mountain and meditate for 7 years straight, well, that's great, but you know, the mortgage doesn't get paid, your house gets foreclosed on, the car gets repossessed, and all the family that you're supposed to support don't get any money to help them. So you actually have to then come back and go, okay, so where's the balance? It's a dance. It's a dance. And you know, each of us navigates that differently, and you've got to find how you can do that.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I have daily practices that I work on to help me be present for my kids or work that I need to do or a client that's in front of me, or even to enjoy myself, I have to be present. So I have to learn how to be still enough to enjoy something.
Powerful, man. You are a wise man. I'm sitting here listening to you, and I just can't help but put myself in that, all these situations, because I've been there, and I'm still doing it. I'm still trying to find that path and that balance you're talking about. I mean, when I'm, you know, I always hate going back to me, but it's like when I'm talking to somebody who's as wise as you and writing about these things that, you know, that we experience as humans, just to take that moment and to breathe before you start something or walk into a room, like you were saying, it's everything. It absolutely is. I feel like I've rushed through my life so many times and just not allowed myself to just center myself and be present. I love that whole philosophy. It's fantastic. And true too about the car. That's like why they always say, you know, like, don't look at your cell phone, right? As soon as you look to the right or something, you're veering off the side of the road. So great analogy.
We know this stuff. It's just making it practical to do it. And sometimes that's like the support network, the right kind of people around you. Sometimes it's about changing your routine every day. Sometimes it's about creating little disruptive moments that can be like every time. You know, one of my mentors turned around and said, you know, I'm still so busy. For 30 seconds. It's like mad. I'm like, that's what works for them. You know, they walk through a doorway and it's like, oh, I take 10 breaths. And I center myself because everything else is crazy busy. Like, okay, that works for them. So you got to find what works for you. And it's a journey.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Another question I had, it's, you know, and we might have touched a little bit on it, but how can we overcome the fears that are getting in the way of happiness and success?
Okay. How can we overcome the fears that are getting in the way of happiness and success? Recognizing the fear is one of the most powerful lessons that I'm still learning. You know, we get into fear before we know it a lot of the time, and fear has a physical manifestation and then it has a story component, you know. So the fear basically shows up and it's like, you know, I think there's an amazing writer in New York. I've forgotten her name. She's she illustrates books as well. This is My Friend Fear is her book, and it's absolutely wonderful. The moment we get familiar with the sensation. So for me, it was like a tightening in my chest, you know, kind of energy building up in my forearms, a tightness in the back of my neck, my breathing getting very shallow. You know, they are the sensations of fear. Yeah. And they're the body's tool to go get ready for danger. You know, we touched on this, like you say, a little bit. You know, that's natural. Fear, that response is not negative or positive. It was to help us function as beings in a world that were at risk. What we have is we have cell phones and Instagram and TikTok and news and friends and what have you, who trigger that response. I'm not using the word triggered that we all use, but literally from a physiological, biomechanical point of view, that happens, these things start to happen physiologically. Okay. Recognizing that takes being present again and being aware. Oh, this is what's happening. I'm beginning to get into fear. This fear is trying to tell me something. What's it trying to tell me? Is it, I've got a deadline, I'm going to miss it, I've got an essay for school and I'm not going to do it? And is it that I forgot to take the trash out, it's bin day, and I'm going to get told off by my spouse or partner, what have you, because this is the seventh time in a row I've forgotten to take the trash out? And I go, you know, you have, or is it something real? You know, fear itself in terms of that is not a bad thing. We have amazing ways of managing fear that we rarely tap into until we recognize it. Breathing, this sounds so dumb, but again, as you notice, most of this conversation is about how simple this stuff is.
Yeah.
Breathing is our body's way of managing our physiological response. If you breathe out longer than you breathe in, you will calm your autonomic nervous system and your fear will begin to flow away. Now, let me just say that again. If you breathe out longer than you breathe in, your autonomic nervous system, which is built into your body, will begin to reduce all those fear sensations, okay? But when we get in fear, it's like we hold our breath.
Yeah.
We do short breaths. We breathe from the top of our chest here. Learning literally little tools on how to modulate, change, modify the way we breathe. Because I'm beginning to feel fear. What do I need to do? Oh, I'm going to get fear. Right, okay. Deep breaths. We learned that when we were kids. Mm-hmm. Count to 10, we'd say to our kids, if they're getting all you know, that applies to adults. We just don't do it. So yeah. There's the fear. Then there's anxiety. And anxiety is around the story that re-triggers the fear. So the biggest one for most people is public speaking. You know, I'm using that because it's a little safer than, you know, walking down a dark street or fear of other things that happen because of trauma. That bit, nothing is going to happen to you, really, when you public speak. Someone heckles you, but everybody else in the audience, if they're human, has some degree of empathy. So they also know what it feels like to stand in front of people and talk. So, you know, I've done lots of public speaking coaching for lots and lots of different people over the years. And the reality is there are lots of practical things you can do, but you are telling yourself the story that I'm going to fail. People are going to laugh at me. I'm going to forget my lines or whatever I'm supposed to say or what have you. This is going to be a big mess. And ultimately what you're telling yourself is you're going to be rejected. One of our biggest fundamental fears from when you look at anthropological history, how we developed as human beings, is to be rejected by the tribe. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the worst things that can happen to us, isolated, rejected. So we tell ourselves a story that we're going to screw up and get rejected.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the story. The reality is you're not. Fear is a sensation you experience. Anxiety is the psychological construct, the story that's happening, which has emotions attached to it. And emotions are both story and physiological. So looking at that, when we go, it's not easy to public speak, but what can I do to make it easier for me? And then you go with curiosity to explore what you can do to make it easier for you. Learn it, work hard at it, do this, you know, and recognize that actually, and this is something that Bruce Springsteen said years and years ago when he was counseling a younger artist who was having panic attacks. It was like, she was telling him that she was having difficulty getting on stage because she'd feel energy build up in her forearms and her breath would get tight and you know, she'd have a little bit of the shakes and what have you. And he said, wow, that's exactly how I feel every time I go on stage. And you know what that is? That's my anticipation. That's me telling me I'm ready for this. And there was just a question of reframing what fear was for. The physical manifestation was one thing. So reframing helps retell the story. So the public speaking is one thing, performing is another. You know, I remember sitting on a plane years ago talking to an amazing kid who was really, really scared because he had a nut allergy that was really, really intense. I mean, proper hospitalization if he even breathes in something. Yeah. It's terrifying. And he was really, really scared. And I talked to him. I'd just seen this amazing TV show where they dealt with the same thing. So I borrowed it all. So, you know, all this wisdom stuff, it's all been said before. It's all been done before. It's all been packaged over many years. It's just how we present it. So I'm taking a story and say, look, fear is your greatest superpower. Your fear, that physiological response, helps you breathe more deeply if you need to and get more oxygen to the lungs. It helps you sense temperature and everything else that's going on around you. You know that sensation where your hair's gone end? Mm-hmm. It's so you're more alert. You can run faster, jump higher, respond quicker than anybody else when you're in fear. Fear is a superpower.
Yeah.
Anxiety, not particularly helpful. That's your mind planning to fail.
Okay. Yeah. You know, it is funny where I watch like children and and most of them, they don't have much fear because it hasn't really been taught to them yet, or they haven't experienced it or seen so many people being in fear. Like they're just, they charge right into something and they breathe deeply. And, you know, it's funny when you go into meetings with certain people, you can tell who have people that have that same kind of anxiety because they are breathing shallow. They are taking short breaths because they're not relaxing or having that moment. So I guess my point is if we could all just kind of get back to that carefree ideology of not having to stress or worry and just breathe.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's way harder to do than we say. And that's why we find practices and things to help us, because the simplicity of it is powerful. Our bodies know how to deal with stress. We don't. Our minds are in a construct that we call culture, which is on drama, fear, attention, everything outside. And actually, kids are taught that. They don't come with it naturally. We learn it. So I talk a lot about, our cultural conditioning. And it's like conditioning is training. And the reality is we've trained ourselves into a state of anxiety. Yes, there's lots of psychological and neurobiological predeterminants as well. I'm not belittling any of that. But for the vast majority of us with generalized anxiety disorder, what have you, we have trained ourselves to be anxious. The beautiful thing about training is we can retrain ourselves. So it is beautiful to see kids and be reminded, they're not just blank slates. They're actually models. It's like, I can learn something here. Okay, that's how they approached it. It's not to be carefree. I don't need to pay the mortgage or pay the car note or make sure I've got a job. But it's like the carefree is worry-free. I haven't got a story telling me how bad this is going to be. You and I have brought all our stories with us, and then we project them. That's what's going to happen. And then we get so not present that we don't even recognize the stories that are telling us that it's going to be really shitty, or excuse me, it's going to fail in the future. And so then we're in anxiety and we don't know why we're in anxiety. And then we're feeling anxious about being anxious because I won't be able to do what I'm meant to do because I'm anxious. And then the sensations build up and then you're just in a loop.
Yeah.
So you just got to find something to disrupt the loop. And that's where putting in place little strategies and plans and practices and then practicing them over days and weeks and months that become lifestyle is what gives us the opportunity to not believe the stories we're telling ourselves about ourselves and be more present.
And these are some of the keys that they can find in your best-selling book, Unlocking a More Productive You.
Yeah. I mean, that book, The Unlocking a More Productive You, was all about, you can get really busy and you can get really effective at doing lots and lots of things. But what happens if they're not the things you really want? You just get really busy about doing lots and lots of things. That was me. So Unlocking a More Productive You was around actually figuring out what matters most. Because then you can use the tools and disciplines of productivity to actually do what matters most. Spend more time with the kids if that's important to you. Build, this nonprofit that's going to help people. Solve that particular thorny, academic problem. But if all you're doing is firefighting everything else and being really busy, and you're one of those people who gets through 100 things a day and everyone goes, wow, you're so productive, and yet you haven't figured out how to read a book because you haven't read a book for the last 6 years, you just for fun, because it's a beautiful thing to do and it's very good for you, healthy for you, busy is not productive. Productive is actually doing the stuff that matters, maybe. So why don't we find time? So I wrote that book first because I was too scared to write Be More. So I was like, let's take all that stuff about being productive and see if I can communicate some of the stuff that I've learned and I'm still learning about how to actually focus on what matters most. And then bring all the other tools of how do you make space in your day? How do you harness habits? How do you do all that lot to get there? Because I didn't really want to tell the story of actually, even that wasn't enough. I had to learn to be more. And then I finally got to writing that. And that book is about some of the psychological constructs that have me driving with the brakes on, and then figuring out that, you know, actually, you know, there is a magnificence to each one of us that we can connect with. There is the magic of human connection. And then there's a mystery of our place in the universe. And if we can deal with some of the psychological stuff and then deal with the sort of more spiritual stuff, those two things really do equip us for having a sense of peace and a sense of connectedness and creativity and more compassion, and to operate in the world in a much more beautiful and peaceful way while still being really effective and productive and what have you. If we can do those two things, or at least do some of them, then I found that works for me. And, you know, some people find some wisdom in that for them. So that's why I wrote the second book.
Yeah. And what's the most important lesson that you bring to some of the high profile companies, clients that you've coached and worked with over the years?
It's relationship stupid. sorry, that's it. So often, you know, I'd get brought in for a particular reason. There's something that someone goes, oh, we want to enter this new market. We've stopped being innovative. The leadership team don't have any followers. You know, you're supposed to be a leader, but nobody's actually going where you want them to go. You know, they're usually the trigger points. They're the ones that, oh, let's get a coach in of some kind. And Charlie's a little bit more one of those woo-woo coaches. He's got some really serious credentials, but he really is woo-woo. So, but the testimonials are good, so maybe. And so most of my work's by referral anyway. So the lesson is fundamentally, so you're having an issue convincing new investors to invest in your company. Well, that's a relational issue that may have some practical issues around your business model, or your financial model, or trust. Okay, so you can start working on the relationships, and you're going to have to become more authentic. I don't mean vomit up your inner thoughts, but it's like actually being integrous, being true and solid and correct, and not projecting, but actually being clear with your words. There's a wonderful Vedic mantra, which is all around being impeccable with your word. And for me, that's going, oh, let my yes be yes and my no be no. Let me not try and do all this dance around and, you know, hide stuff. It's just, oh, this is clear. So part of that is being clear with investors. But that's a relational thing. You have to build trust. And then people go, well, then it's my team. Okay, same. So they're arm's length, or it's customers. Do the customers. Same thing. You have to build trust relationships with your customers. Then it's the same with your team. They see everything. They feel everything. They're human beings. You've got to figure out how to do relationship better. Doesn't matter how good your strategy is. It all comes down to relationships. Mm-hmm. But then when you do that, nearly every single organization that I've worked with, especially the senior leadership team and the very senior leaders, it always comes back to, then it's relationship with family. I've been doing this for years and blah, blah, blah. So it goes customers, investors, leadership team, then family, and then it's relationship with self. And that's where you get the biggest breakthrough that often changes the whole kind of trajectory and then the DNA of the organization. Managing and correcting and finding an appropriate, healthy relationship with self, because then that spins all the way out, back out to how you deal with investors, how you honor your customers, how you treat, believe in, create boundaries for, and build high-performing teams. It only comes from you having a really, really solid, integrous, authentic relationship with self. Mm-hmm. That's the hardest work for any of them to do. But the lesson is, it's relationships.
Yeah.
It's always relationships. It's everything from, so there you go.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
All my guests on my show take a ride in the Jacob Young time machine.
Okay.
What advice would you give to teenage self?
Don't be so intense. I was always known for being intense, you know, and you can probably see echoes of that even now. There's kind of like this energy. There's like a, and I think I took everything so seriously as a teenager. I was like, this has to be right. You know, and for me, it was performing for my parents. I have to be good enough for them. That was the, you know, there were high expectations. And so I came up in a culture of, you know, anything's possible for you, Charlie, but you better fulfill it. Mm. You know, you can do anything. So you better had, you know, so that was kind of, you know, and, you know, I love my parents, my father's no longer with us, and I've got a beautiful relationship with my mum now, But I'd constructed that. You know, we tend to blame our parents, what have you. But the time machine, to go back to your point, don't be so intense. It doesn't matter is one thing I want to tell myself. It really doesn't matter. You don't need to care what other people think about. You don't need to care about that. So don't be so intense. But also, you know what? The smallest things do matter. Mm-hmm. But they matter because they are valuable, not because of how you perform in them, you know? Mm-hmm. So enjoy doing that just because there's enjoyment in it. Don't enjoy doing that because you've got to become the best at it so that you can get your approval of your parents, what have you, you know? So I wish myself would have been that. So don't take yourself so seriously. Don't be so intense. Yeah. Enjoy the ride, but take responsibility. It's your responsibility, not somebody else's.
Yeah. And one more question, another question I ask all my guests, my sponsor, Boys Town, their motto is, he ain't heavy, he's my brother. And story is, back at the turn of the century when Father Flanagan came over from Ireland, and against all odds of race, color, creed, he was taking children in well before, you know, legally it could even happen.
Wow.
And, but they were dealing with funding issues, and several of the boys were, you know, coming out of the Great Depression and whatnot, and they didn't have wheelchairs and medical equipment. So there was one boy in particular that he couldn't walk. So the boys would take turns carrying him to class and to football games and, you know, whatnot. And one day Father said, isn't he heavy? And one boy turned to him while he was carrying him and said, he's not heavy, Father, he's my brother. Meaning in our lives, we've all had someone at some point carry us.
Yeah.
Who's carried you, Charlie?
It's amazing when you say that, because I get a whole bunch of goosebumps and I'm in tears, you know, the prickling tears, because I think the lack of acknowledgement for me of all the people who have carried me is one of the things that, you know, I want to honor and reflect on. You know, there are so many people from, you know, what I contributed when I take contribution for my failed marriages before, they carried some part of that, my former wives. So I'm grateful. And it's really hard when you've had a relationship breakup for that gratitude to move across the divide of a breakup and actually be meaningful. But that's true. They carried part of me. They had to deal with an emotionally unavailable individual. So I'm grateful for that. There's so many teachers and spiritual leaders in my world that I ignore or thought that I was cleverer than or knew more than, that actually their patience, seeing me make the same mistakes that every other human being does who hasn't done their work and get into more scrapes. Yeah, they've carried me. I think one of the people that I want to honor the most right now, well, there's Abby, my wife, and Carla Mullen. Carla Mullen is a therapist who taught me accountability and possibility. So Carla has carried me and done serious work, so I want to honor her as well. But then there's,
thank you.
You can just go on. This is like you just keep going on.
Yeah. It can too. It can take, it's an army. Once you start thinking about it, and that's a question I ask myself all the time, and it's always like, yeah, and then there was that person too, and there was, it could have been something simple. Could have been something really impactful. But it's, you know, the one question that one thing that comes up so many times when I have guests, not so many times, there's always like 3% or 4% of people that come on the show and they say, I carried myself. Nobody helped me. And then I think, well, that's a really sad existence if that's the case. But I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I see what you mean when you say it's a sad existence. I think the more we, you know, one of the things that I finish the book on, the Be More book, is about that we are love. And we are love recognizes that, hey, we're each on a journey. We are this spiritual being, whether it's you have a relationship with a higher power or not, there is something bigger than us that has allowed us to have consciousness, the ability to perceive that, oh, we exist. You have that. I have that. And for me, I've found that there is a beauty in being able to see other people beyond their cultural conditioning and biological programming. So even though someone has a different opinion or a different view or whatever, they are different, we can be absolutely fascinated by the uniqueness of that person and still appreciate you're just trying to make your way in the world and you're trying to figure it out and you're trying to manage that inner life and you're trying to love and be loved. For me, if you made it by yourself, it sounds like your capacity to appreciate that is very small. Mm. I don't know if that's their experience. It might just be fear, but that's what I think I hear. Mm-hmm. So then in that moment, I have compassion and go, I wonder what happened that they became so small. Because my world has just got bigger. I thought my world was big when I was running around the world on planes. My world got bigger the moment I could stop and appreciate. That's when my world really got bigger. So, yeah, that's a shame for them. And that's their journey and that's whatever they'll be on. But for me, appreciating there's no such thing because we cannot exist in isolation. You know, we are a connected consciousness. You know, we can look at the science, the neuroscience of consciousness and see, okay, what's going on here? Yeah, we are connected. You cannot be isolated. The moment we isolate, we begin to die.
Yeah.
And that happens for our inner life as much as our physiological life. Who makes the coffee that you bought? There's 50 people in the chain of making that coffee. So if you have coffee to make those decisions because you want to be alert in the morning, they did that for you. You're not self-made. You know, that's...
True. So true.
That's just one example. Anyway.
Well, Charlie, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time to enlighten us today. I mean, even though this is our first time meeting, of course, we have an old friend that's in common, your wife, Abby, from the New York days.
Abby.
So please tell your beautiful wife, Abby, hello. And I know that you two are making each other very happy. And everyone, of course, that is checking out the podcast, please go to charliehughjones.com for more information and get Charlie's latest copy of a copy of his latest book, Unlocking a More Productive You. Thank you so much, Charlie.
Oh, Jacob, no, appreciate being on the show. If I can just, the latest book isn't on the website. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it on Amazon. And it's called Be More. What to do when you can't do anymore. That's the latest book.
Oh, well, I appreciate the clarification. Yeah, so Barnes & Nobles. And where else?
Amazon.
Of course, Amazon.
Yes, of course.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you so much, Charlie.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you, Jacob.
And that's about all the time we have for this week, but the Boys Town toll-free national hotline, 1-800-448-3000, is a 24/7 crisis resource and referral number for kids and their parents. They're there to help anyone having suicidal thoughts, risking any type of self-harm, parenting problem, physical, sexual, or emotional abuse, stress, anxiety, anger problems, school problems like bullying, peer pressure, and of course, chemical dependency. If you're suffering with any of these issues or you just need someone to talk to, someone is there for you 24/7. Just call the Boys Town National Hotline, 1-800-448-3000. Don't feel like talking? Text VOICE to 20121. Someone will get back to you immediately. Boys Town, saving children, healing families. Till next time, love yourself and love each other.